House Labor and Commerce Committee to order. Today is Monday, January 30th. Let the record reflect the time is 3:15 p.m. Today we have present Representative Sadler, Representative Prox, Representative Ruffridge, Representative Wright, Representative Fields, and myself, Chair Sumner. The staff that will be assisting us today are Sophia Tenney from House Records and Zachary Lawhorn with the LIO. Jesse Logan, temporary committee aide. Before we get into scheduled bill presentations, I would like to appoint Representative Ruffridge as my vice chair. We have two items on the agenda today. The committee will hear House Bill 13 and House Bill 46. My intention is to hear an introduction to both bills along with any invited testimony, then hold both bills for a later date. The first bill in the order today is House Bill 13, sponsored by Representative Josephson. Please come to the table and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Andy Josephson. I am a state representative from District 13 at South Midtown. With me is my staff, Alexander Schroeder. And we are ready to talk to you about House Bill 13. We thank you for calendaring it. We should have online, I hope, Mr. Rob Corbisier, who is the director of the state Alaska State Commission on Human Rights. And we might as well have an attorney online, Ms. Nauman, in the event there are questions about the language in what admittedly is a very short bill. So, The context of why we're here is fairly straightforward. Since 1963, the state has had a human rights commission. I'm proud to tell you that my father, at age 29, voted for it when he was in the state house. This is back during the Kennedy era, so this is a while ago. And its jurisdiction hasn't changed very substantially since then. It does not cover nonprofits. And we asked Ledge Research, and so what this bill does is say, no, you will have jurisdiction over most, not all, nonprofits. We asked Ledge Research up the hill, why is it that about 40,000 Alaskans in their place of employment in nonprofits are not subject to the jurisdiction of the State Human Rights Commission? And frankly, it couldn't really, in a two-page memo, tell us. So we don't know why or what was on the mind of legislators in 1963 or since then when there have been a small, as far as I know, amendments to the bill. First, a little background on what the Human Rights Commission does. The Human Rights Commission came out of a period, I said 1963, when nationally there was a movement to, as seen through the Civil Rights Act, for example, to tamp down and make illegal a discrimination based on race and color and creed and national origin, that sort of thing. And so it comes from that era in our politics. There is and was created after our own ASHER, or Alaska State Human Rights Commission, and its body of law. There was a law passed creating the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. You all have heard about that. That is our sort of parent agency. I think they operate out of Seattle. They typically operate or have jurisdiction over larger businesses or, I guess, corporations that have more than 15 or in some circumstances 20 people. Of course, there are a lot of agencies in Alaska that have fewer than that. And we are in a sort of contractual relationship with them where the state And Mr. Corbisier can explain this in much more detail, but the state essentially is an arm of them. And this must be true because they pay us a fee for handling cases that otherwise the EEOC would handle. So they help fund this agency. What the bill does, as I said, is it says that that nonprofits, with the exception essentially of religious and social institutions and entities, will be subject to the jurisdiction of the Alaska Commission on Human Rights. And the Alaska Commission has in Title 18, it lays out how they operate. So what they do fundamentally is try to keep people out of court by using a conciliation and investigation process. If they find there's, quote, substantial evidence of discrimination, they pursue an investigation, and then they try to essentially bring the sides together. They try to educate people who I guess concede that they were discriminatory in practice. They can impose remedies. Now, ultimately, I think an employer can dispute the remedy, and or a landlord, mind you, can dispute the remedy and force the matter into court. But it's designed to keep those sorts of attorney's fees and the like down and reach reconciliation when it can. But they do take cases to court on behalf of petitioners, does the agency. In 2018, at least, they could have done it sooner, but we have a resolution from 2018 where the then commission under then Governor Walker, and so I note that because probably a lot of the commissioners were appointed by Governor Walker, said that they want the change that we brought before you today. Now, what's I think interesting is that last fall, there was another resolution by a commission entirely appointed by Governor Dunleavy that said the same thing. We want this resolution. Incidentally, at least nominally, the Human Rights Commission is housed in the office of the governor. So there are lots of interesting sort of interplays going on here. So what this bill would do is it would provide jurisdiction, and we think this is needed because there's a gap in that jurisdiction. So if for example, I typically use red hair because that's my example of something that perhaps wouldn't happen, a type of discrimination. But let's say, and it's therefore not so sensitive maybe, but at any rate, let's say someone was discriminated against in housing or employment in Anchorage because they have red hair, all right? What would happen is they could take their claim to the Anchorage Human Rights Commission or the Anchorage Equal Rights Commission, and the commission would probably find that dubious because it's not a typically discriminatory category. But at any rate, if they found otherwise that this was some pattern or practice, then the Anchorage Equal Rights Commission would have jurisdiction over that case. Now, all other locations in Alaska would not have if they were a nonprofit. The Human Rights Commission would lack that jurisdiction. So we have this sort of uneven playing field, and this is designed to equalize that playing field. You know, incidentally, looked at through a more conservative lens, the for-profit companies and organizations are subject to the human rights laws, and nonprofits aren't. And it begs the question, again, why are nonprofits given this, I guess, privilege? And you might ask, well, how many cases would there be? Well, last year alone, the Human Rights Commission, I believe, would report that about 50 cases were not screened in. So someone called and said they've been subject to discrimination, but they work for a nonprofit, and therefore there's a lack of jurisdiction. So that's what this bill is designed to do. And finally, I would note that apparently only about 9 states, and we're one of those 9, do not cover this class of people working in nonprofits. With that, if there's any questions I can answer, I will try to do that. And then I encourage you to invite Mr. Schroeder to put on a brief PowerPoint.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Representative Josephson, for those of us whose circumstances in life have been blessed not to have to deal with the Human Rights Commission, could you please give us a little more information about the number of cases that might present themselves to you? You said that there's maybe 50 cases that were not screened in. Mm-hmm. And so how many cases are there in a given year for the State Human Rights Commission?
Well, I've seen that through
Ballpark
the chair.
Will do.
Mm-hmm. I've seen that recently. And so I'm looking for that. And I'm trying to remember what that number is. Mr. Schroeder, do you recall?
One thing I know for sure is that Mr. Corbisier, who should be on the line, would know that instantly.
Oh, very good.
Representative Ruppert.
Thank you. I just needed to make sure before we got too far that I declared a potential conflict, as my wife currently serves as a commissioner on the Human Rights Commission. So just needed that for the record.
You are not recused.
when it comes time, we'll object.
Mr. Chair, if I might, to save Mr. Corbisier the headache, I see here in the State Commission's annual report from 2021, and we can provide this for you, very well maybe in your packet. There's a table called Inquiries and Complaints by Year, and it shows a peak in recent years of inquiries of 1,733, and it looks like a basis was established. I'm assuming that a substantial basis was established in 405, but then some got weeded out. The numbers dropped decidedly. But interestingly, in 2021, the number was 674. So that would suggest about a third of what it was just 3 years before. So, I mean, I guess that's, if you're curious, that suggests that there's less discrimination. I don't know. There could be any number. It could be a COVID matter as well, and I suspect that's what it is.
Let the record reflect that Representative Carrick arrived at 3:17.
Mr. Chair, just follow up on that through the chair, Representative Josephson. So just run that. So in 2021, there were 674 cases that were the basis was established. Is that correct? A couple of the years got a little confused with their flow.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Sadler. It says 2021, 674 inquiries.
Inquiries, okay.
All right. And the basis, and we'd have to find out what that means, were 139. Intake, 119. Complaints filed, 106.
Gotcha.
That's what I see.
Thank you.
Perhaps Mr. Schroeder can continue the presentation.
Sure. For the record, my name is Alexander Schroeder. I am a legislative aide to Representative Andy Josephson for State House District 13. And coincidentally, this bill is also House Bill 13, so it's rather fitting. The representative covered quite a few of the points that I plan to cover in the presentation, so I'll try my best not to be repetitive. But there are a few important nuances that we can cover throughout the presentation. So House Bill 13 is a relatively short bill. The sectional analysis shows that it is a single amended section. That section is Alaska Statute 1880-300, subsection 5. And this section, the chapter deals with the State Commission on Human Rights, and this specific section of that chapter just deals with the definitions. The significance of that is these definitions define the parameters of the commission. In subsection 5, we define employer, and it's through defining employer that the commission, its jurisdiction is defined. This bill is to amend that part of the statute and take nonprofit corporations corporations not-for-profit out of that definition, so that they are included as an employer in the state of Alaska in accordance with the State Commission on Human Rights. So just to sort of give a little background, and the representative talked about some of this, but the EEOC is the federal equivalent of the Alaska State Commission on Human Rights. It was created out of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and deals with specifically employment and employment discrimination. And as the representative had pointed out, the differences between our state commission and the federal commission are one important difference is that the federal commission it only covers employees who belong to an employer of at least 15 employees, while in the state of Alaska, it covers any person who employs one or more. And that's an important point to make when we get to the next slide about gaps in coverage for the state commission. So that's the federal level. And then we have the state level commissions. ASHER, as the representative pointed out, was created in 1963. And now we currently are only one of nine states that don't cover nonprofits. So that definition has changed slightly over time, but for the most part, it remains the same as in 1963. So then we have the federal level and the state level, but then we also have municipal level commissions. The Anchorage Equal Rights Commission is a full-blown commission. It takes on cases and complaints, and it settles disputes. But then there's also a few other examples. There's the Juneau Human Rights Commission, which is more of an advisory board that reports to the Assembly recommendations. There's the Fairbanks North Star Bureau, who has a diversity council on this subject. Now, they all have different levels of operating, but the one important thing to note is that they all do cover nonprofits under their jurisdiction. And so you might ask, well, okay, the federal level covers nonprofits, and then we have these municipal levels covering nonprofits. What's the big deal? Why do we need to have a statewide level also cover nonprofits? And I think that's an important thing to note, but there's three reasons that are worth addressing in that type of perspective. The first is that the EEOC has a work share agreement with ASHER, and so on the federal level, they'll give cases to the statewide level, but the statewide level can't take on those types of cases. And EEOC won't even take on cases that are of 14 or less employees. So that's one area where there's a gap. The second area is that, for example, and Mr. Corbusier can talk more about this, but it all depends on where the nonprofit is located physically. So if you're an Anchorage resident, a Juneau resident, or a Fairbanks resident, your municipality or borough might cover nonprofit employees. But if the physical location of the nonprofit is outside one of those jurisdictions, then even if you are a resident of one of those areas, you won't be covered under that municipal or borough code. So there's a gap there that's an issue. And then I think the most important thing to point out with this point is that in some areas of Alaska, you have upwards of over 50% of private employment is directly connected to nonprofits. And I have a chart here that I can share with the committee, but a lot of these areas don't have codes that deal with non-discrimination cases, and so they would rely on a statewide level type of commission to settle those disputes. But in those areas, for example, Sitka City and Borough, 53% of private employment is directly connected to nonprofits. The Nome Census Area, 51%. The Bethel Census Area, 48%. Dillingham, 39%. And you contrast that with Anchorage, only 17%. So these areas are disproportionately affected, and they don't have these types of commissions to settle their disputes. So this slide, it's a captured photo of the annual report that is part of the bill packet. And so why would I put it in there? Well, the language that's in the red there, that's ASHER's legislative goals for the year. For four consecutive years in a row, that exact language has been part of their legislative priorities. It's basically just copy pasted to the next year. So this is an issue that they really want. And as the representative pointed out, all these commissioners have voted unanimously on resolutions, both with commissioners appointed through the Walker administration and with commissioners appointed through the Dunleavy administration. So this is something that carries over time. And then even Rob Corbusier, who's on the line, the executive director of ASHER, supports this legislation as well. So Just to do a little recap, what does the bill do? The bill it amends Alaska Statute 1880, 300, subsection 5 by deleting or omitting nonprofit corporations. But it keeps the other exceptions, including religious, fraternal, and social nonprofit associations. Essentially, that's what it does. And so that's the presentation. If there are any questions, please ask. Thank you.
Questions? Representative Wright.
Mr. Chair, could you give us an example of an instance of something like this, why we need this kind of bill? You know, just something specific. I know you did the red hair, but just something pertaining to this with nonprofits would be nice.
Through the chair, Representative Wright, I can't, but Mr. Corbusier probably could. And the reason I can't is these are phone calls or visits or perhaps a paper complaint that come in, and they die quickly because the executive director and his team look at it, they see it's a nonprofit, and they just dispense with it. So it could be... It could be any organization. I'm going to guess that the Red Cross is a nonprofit. So their local Anchorage office, if there was discrimination based on one of these protected classes, there's just nothing that our Human Rights Commission could do for them. And I don't know. I suspect Mr. Corbusier can find a way to answer that without disclosing some protected application. If he's online, Mr. Chair.
And so, seeing no more questions, I think we'll move on to invited test. Oh, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a couple questions, if I may, of the sponsor. Through the chair, Representative Josephson, have you reviewed any of the minutes of the original law bill that your dad voted on to see what the those creating the commission thought about employer and why they chose the definition they did? Have you been able to find any historical evidence of consideration of this issue?
Through the chair, if Mr. Shorter will hand me the document from Ledge Research, they indicate in there if you're ever interested in doing any research and you go back before about 1990, it gets sketchy. So they if I might quote. This is from Ms. Higgins of Ledge Research, which is essentially, as I understand it, an arm of Ledge Legal. And she says, quote, "We reviewed applicable records held at the Legislative Reference Library. However, due to the age of the relevant measures, their legislative history is limited to journal entries, versions of the bill, and enacted legislation. We located no committee minutes for any of the relevant bills. The absence of contextual documentation leaves us unable to determine the rationale for the exception."
I'll go to the chair. Representative Joseph, have you been able to ask at home, ask your father about what
through the chair? I have him on speed dial, and I could ask him, but he, you know, a lot's happened since then to all of us, and I can ask him.
Great. And if I could continue with another question, Mr. Chairman, through the chair, Representative Josephson. And maybe Mr. Schroeder, you described the three levels at which non-discrimination claims can be brought. Is the same, and I guess I couldn't quite follow your point, is the same definition of employer used in two but not the third, the state? That is the same definition of employer used for the local human rights commissions in the federal but not the state, or is it consistent? And would this bill change it to make it consistent over all three domains?
Through the chair, if Mr. Schroeder doesn't know, I wouldn't blame him. Go ahead.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, the definitions aren't, they vary. So the EEOC's definition is going to define an employer as somebody who has at least 15 employees. The municipal level just defines it more similarly to the statewide commission. As just a person who employs one or more, I believe that's the case, and their exceptions vary too. Typically, there are religious exemptions, and some, and like with the chart, with the state-to-state chart there, you'll see some similarities, such as social clubs or fraternal. But typically they're going to vary, although their work share agreement, from my understanding, their work share agreement allows them to coordinate that. But Mr. Corbusier would probably be a better source to.
If I could, Mr. Chair, I would want to put that question to Rob when he comes online, just to find out what the definitions are. And again, if this would apply to all of them.
Representative Carrick.
Yeah, thank you through the chair to Representative Josephson or your staff. This is a pretty basic question, but I'm curious what an example is of a fraternal organization. And then also looking at the documentation from 4-Acre Group, religious organizations and religious nonprofits are more than double the next sector. So I'm just curious what the rationale is for them not being included as an employer, if that's something across the state, like Representative Sadler was sort of getting at, and then the potential impact of including them, or just the rationale a little bit more why they're not a part of this bill, those two categories.
Sure. And I'll see if I can't find, through the chair, I'll see if I can't find an answer on this definition for the AERC, the Anchorage Equal Rights Commission. As to the second part on religious organizations, this is a muddled area of the law that's evolving. Typically, the way I think of it is, for example, this: if a parochial school had a janitor, one would think that cleaning is cleaning. There's no sort of, with the exception of the altar, there's no religious cleaning. It's just cleaning. And so you might say that the denomination of or the spiritual beliefs of the janitor are immaterial and they should be covered under this law and related laws. And sometimes those issues arise. But generally it's what you expect. For example, my wife's church, which is a Missouri Synod Lutheran church, does not permit, female clergy. And I don't want them to be required to permit female clergy, right? That is a failed exercise on lots of levels. So that's the explanation for that. Your first question though, again, was what?
Through the chair, just a really basic question. Can you give any examples of a social or fraternal organization?
Sure. Through the chair, the one that comes up a lot in the law is, JCs. So I found, and I don't know much about the JCs, but it is a fraternal organization, and there was a case in Alaska history, and I printed that case, and it's an example of a situation where the Human Rights Commission was confronted with a JC's, I think, resistance. It's a case from 1983 to being treated as anything other than nonprofit and not subject to the human rights law. But there are countless groups like that. Another one, and because I just know this from teaching constitutional law, was the Boy Scouts of America. They famously sued in a case called Boy Scouts versus Dale, and were not required to, in that case, have an LGBT scout guide, if that's what they're called, or scout leader. Scoutmaster. They have since unilaterally changed their position on that, as I understand it. But that's the kind of thing you get into. And just to be clear, as we've said, we're not changing any part of that law. We do, and you could talk to Mr. so that I'm not called out on this. We do drop the words charitable and educational. We think that social and fraternal cover the exception. We also have the word religious in our bill still. We would have to ask the director, Corbusier, why they wanted and recommended the dropping of charitable and educational. I could not find, even though there are definitions, six of them, of the word charitable, none of them relate to Title 18, so they don't really provide any value. And essentially, this bill is mirrored on the wishes of the commission itself, and it's essentially our lawyers wrote what the commission asked for. And so that's where we are in the language.
So I believe we can move along to invited testimony of Mr. Corbisier. Mr. Corbisier, can you hear us?
I'm here. Shall I begin?
Yep. Go ahead.
There we go. So the Alaska State Commission for Human Rights enforces Article 1, Section 3 of the Alaska Constitution, which is the civil rights provision that essentially says you're not allowed to discriminate against someone based on their membership in a protected class. The second sentence of that states that the legislature shall implement this section, and the Human Rights Commission is the legislative implementation of that constitutional provision. We have jurisdiction essentially over five subject matter areas. Those are employment, public accommodation, the sale and rental of real property, credit and financing, and government practices. We also have jurisdiction over retaliation cases. Usually a retaliation case comes in the context of one of those other five cases. I want to note that the Juneau Human Rights Commission and the Fairbanks Diversity Council are advisory bodies only. They do not have staff or budget with enforcement responsibilities. So the only other entity that is authorized under state law that has implemented an enforcement mechanism is the Anchorage Equal Rights Commission under Anchorage Municipal Code. Right now, there is a jurisdictional gap. Essentially, if you're a smaller nonprofit with less than 15 employees, you could discriminate against your employees with near impunity. And that means things like sexual harassment cases. So you get hired and your boss says you'll get a promotion if you get on your knees. That's sexual harassment. If you walk in and your boss slaps you on the behind with a squeeze and says, welcome to your first day of work, that's sexual harassment. For disability accommodations, you know, a small nonprofit could be like, well, I just don't feel like giving you a desk that's going to accommodate your wheelchair. And they can effectively get away with it under state law. Now, there is still the opportunity for those individuals who are victims of that kind of discrimination to file their own private civil lawsuit. But, I mean, every now and then, there's like a big case, right? I mean, that'll be worth $80,000 or $100,000. That'll get the attention of a private attorney. But if you get another job within, you know, a couple weeks or a month, you've mitigated your damages pretty significantly. And the Human Rights Commission's authority is only for make-whole relief. So, essentially, for compensatory damages. So if you've got a case that's only worth, you know, $3,000 and an attorney wants a $5,000 retainer to even walk in the door, that case isn't going to go anywhere in a private civil lawsuit. So if you are a small employer outside the municipality of Anchorage with a nonprofit employer outside the municipality of Anchorage with less than 15 employees, there's a jurisdictional gap. There's no reason not to hold those employers to the same standard as any other employer in the state. The Human Rights Commission also has a workshare agreement with the EEOC, which you've heard a little bit about. The number varies from year to year, but essentially, anytime there is a case that is co-jurisdictional, that falls under the jurisdiction of both the Human Rights Commission as well as the EEOC, the state can get, the Human Rights Commission can get an $800 reimbursement per case for closing that case from the EEOC. So, I mean, if we're talking, you know, around 50 cases, that's potentially $40,000 a year that right now we're not able to recover. I admit we do not track the cases that we screen out at the outset. The commission for many years took kind of the same tactic that the EEOC did, that every single person deserves to have their case heard, even obviously non-jurisdictional claims. So you know, people will call the Human Rights Commission and say, like, well, don't I have the right to have clean air or access to food as a human right? Well, I mean, maybe you do, but this isn't the Declaration on Human Rights, Human Declaration on Human Rights. You know, our jurisdiction is limited to those five areas. So we screen those cases out immediately. So if we can determine immediately that, okay, the employer is a nonprofit, a well-known nonprofit, we screen that case out. It doesn't move beyond the inquiry stage. I will defer to Representative Josephson's statistic about how many other states do not have nonprofit jurisdiction. Our research showed that there were only five other states that definitively did not have nonprofit jurisdiction. We are not a punitive agency. You know, we're not out there to try and hang offenders out to dry. The goals are to make a victim whole, and our public policy goals are to make sure it doesn't happen again. So we're looking for the respondents to adopt an enforceable non-discrimination policy that complies with state and federal law, and to maybe implement some training for the employees, as well as the supervisors, managers, and owners. Again, we're trying to eliminate discrimination. And if we can do that by education, then we've done our job. So the language in the bill is not exactly what the commission adopted in its resolution. It is very close. I'm fairly confident that the commission would support the language that is in HB 13. Some of the other questions, so I'm looking at the draft of our annual report. In 2022, we had 814 inquiries. Out of those, the complainant articulated essentially a basis for a case 184 times. So out of those 184, 164 of them moved into the formal intake where we had a lengthier interview with the complainant. And 134 of those went forward with, yes, I'm going to go ahead and sign the complaint and allow Asher to initiate the investigation. I also pulled up the Anchorage Equal Rights Commission. Their definition of employer is in ANC 520.010. And it is broad and simple. It just states employer means a person, public or private, who has one or more employees. And then later on in that vision of code, there is an exception for, in 520.090, there are religious exemptions. I haven't had time to pull up the U.S. code provision, but look at the EEOC definition. I do know, like I said, that the EEOC jurisdiction does include nonprofit employers. With that, take questions.
Any questions? Representative Prox.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. I guess I need to declare a potential conflict of interest as well. My sister-in-law is on the commission.
You are not recused.
I'm forced to participate in this. Okay, very good. So to the director, through the chair, do I understand correctly that the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission would accept cases against nonprofits provided that there are more than 15 employees? Is that, are both conditions correct?
Through the chair, that is correct. So, I mean, right now, anytime that they get a case comes to them with 15, the employer has at least 15 employees, and it's in Alaska, they refer it either to us or the Anchorage Equal Rights Commission if it's within the municipality of Anchorage. And, I mean, I review each one of those referrals. That if I see that it's a nonprofit, I have to tell the EEOC, no, we're not taking that case. We're in jurisdiction. And, I mean, that I can go back through my emails and figure out exactly what that number is. But I have no idea what happens during the intake calls out of the 814 inquiries that happened last year. I mean, the individual investigator who's on duty that day will see, okay, this is a nonprofit. we're not going to do anything else with this case.
Okay. So, follow up through the chair. Do you have any idea why the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the threshold is 15 employees?
Representative Fox, through the chair, I do not. Purely speculation, but I mean, based on my time working with the assistant DA as well, I mean, the feds generally look at bigger cases. They're not looking at smaller time offenders. So my gut tells me they want to deal with the larger employers and let state and local commissions deal with the smaller ones.
Thank you. I'll give someone else a chance.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Corbusier, you know, if you could please kind of simply lay out the jurisdiction of the local, state, and federal, I'll call them lowercase human rights commissions. I confess I'm getting a little confused about the jurisdictional gap of up to 15 Anchorage. So if you can just lay out simply what the current situation is, so we have just some basis of what status quo is.
Representative Sadler, through the chair. So I'm not totally schooled on Anchorage Municipal Code when it comes to Anchorage Equal Rights Commission. I believe their jurisdiction is almost identical to Asher's, with the exception of they have explicit jurisdiction over LGBTQ as a protected basis. So they do have jurisdiction over nonprofit corporations that are physically located within the municipality of Anchorage, all the way down to just a single employee.
Okay.
The EEOC doesn't take a case unless there are at least 15 employees. Okay. The EEOC also has jurisdiction over nonprofits as well as for-profit employers and governments.
Okay.
We also, the Human Rights Commission, the Alaska Commission for Human Rights also has jurisdiction over governments. I mean, we jurisdiction over the legislature, because the legislature is an employer. We've got jurisdiction over the court system. We've got jurisdiction over the executive branch,
sure,
as well as all local municipalities.
So follow up through the chair, Mr. Capozzi. So the Alaska Asher of the Human Rights Commission covers down to one, but does not cover nonprofits. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, that is correct.
Very good. So the jurisdictional gap, goodness, I got a lot of questions. Can I ask just briefly, what is the cost to operate the State Commission of Human Rights? Just what's your budget? I'm not trying to ask a targeted question, just trying to get some idea of how much activity is funded in the commission.
Representative Sadler, through the chair, no problem. We're just a little over $2 million.
About $2 million, we'll stay there for the $2 million? Very good.
Just a little over $2 million. Our federal receipts are like, I think they were $120,000 last year.
Okay. And my last question.
I mean, we're essentially a mile of a grind and repave project of a road. We're less than the cost of a grind and repave project for 1 mile.
Appreciate that. And my last question through the chair, Mr. Corbusier. You referenced, as did Representative Josephson, the $80 or $800 per case the federal government will reimburse. Are there any associated costs to clear a case? In other words, if we get $800, what does that obligate the state to spend? And is that potential $40,000 going to provide a net benefit or a net cost to the state? So my question is,
Representative Sadler, through the chair. My understanding is that technically that going back to the general fund, and then whether it's subject to the reverse sweep, because I think it does have to be dedicated to the agency. I'm not sure. In terms of the net cost to the state, we've got the capacity to accept cases right now. I mean, if you look at our case numbers, the agency intentionally tried to start screening cases out at the outset, starting like circa 2016, 2017. It was before my time. And part of that was the notion of, look, we shouldn't be giving people false hope. You know, somebody comes to our door and yes, come in, please sit down. But it's, no, this case isn't going anywhere. And we can see that in the first 30 seconds that they sit down. Now, if someone comes in complaining about, you know, clean water, we shouldn't be taking that case in. So there was a much more aggressive effort to screen cases out. And then, honestly, right after I started in late 2019, we entered the pandemic. And if people weren't working, they weren't complaining about discrimination. And the people that did have jobs were probably fearful of losing those jobs. And so they weren't complaining about discrimination. And with the implementation of a lot of teleworking, if there aren't those conversations happening at the water cooler, those interactions in the hallway, there's less opportunities for that kind of obvious discrimination that still takes place in the workplace. And our case numbers have gone back up. We've seen some slight blips here and there for various reasons. And like I said, this last year, our case load did go back up. But we've got the capacity easily to absorb 50 cases. On top of that, we've implemented some fairly significant structural changes in the last year, 2 years, that are eliminating a lot of the backlog. One of the agency goals going on 40 years has been to get our average case investigation under a year. And with a change we implemented at the beginning of last year, I think we're going to end up hitting that target right now. Definitely next year, we have a full year of data with this regulation change. So we've got the capacity to do this without costing the state anything.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Corbett. Just to clarify, real simple answer. So you say that the sponsor statement, and you have said that if you were able to accept 50 more cases, you would take in $800 per case with a potential of $40,000. And you say you've already got budget, so there would be no additional cost to state general funds if that were the case?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, that's correct. Assuming those cases could be co-filed with the EEOC, they'd have to be co-jurisdictional cases. There are a lot of larger nonprofit employers with the state in the state of Alaska as well. I mean, looking at some of the Fork Group data, switch my slides here. On the talking points that I've got going back from Forker database in 2018, there were over 550,000 nonprofits in the state. 77% of those were 501c3s that were charitable, and of those, 30% are religious. But there are nearly 45,000 employees that would potentially be covered by this change. Healthcare is the largest field by far, with 17,645 employees and approximately $2.3 billion in revenue in 2016. That would then fall under our jurisdiction.
So again, it would not cost the state any additional GFs if this were to happen. You'd pocket that $40,000 with 50 more cases, and there would be no additional ding to the state's budget. I understand that's correct. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Josephson.
May I ask Mr. Corbusier one question? Mr. Corbusier, the in terms of the difference between our drafting version of the bill, which is the only version, version 33LS0208/A, and your resolution, it seems like they're essentially identical, except that the draft removes the word club. Am I right about that?
To the chair, Representative Josephson, let me pull the other document up. I believe the language that was adopted by the commission in the resolution more specifically relied on the religious exemption that is provided for in regulation. The language specifically in the resolution stated, and I quote, "Employer means a person, including the state and a political subdivision of the state, who has one or more employees in the state, but does not include an organization or club that is exclusively social or fraternal and is not organized for private profit." End quote.
Right. Follow up. if I might, the draft doesn't change anything about the religious association or corporation carve out.
What I see difference is the removal of the word club.
Get back to the other document. Yeah, I think you're correct on that.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your presentation, Representative Josephson, Mr. Schroeder, and Mr. Corbusier. I think we'll, in the interest of brevity, we will hold questions at this time and get on to our next bill hearing. We will get another crack at this. And we'll take a brief at ease while we get the next bill ready. Committee, please come back to order. We are back on the record. The second bill today is House Bill 46, sponsored by committee member Representative Fields. Please come to the table and begin your presentation.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman, and thanks for starting off with early in the session with child care. Just a little bit of history behind this bill for members who weren't here last year. So last year, the House passed a bill very similar to this, and that bill was the product of an iterative process starting in the Labor and Commerce Committee, where I brought forward a couple of different child care ideas, and basically this one attracted more interest and support from within the sector, and the House ended up passing it. And I guess my approach to this would be, let's get the best child care bill through the House that we can, and maybe it's this bill or maybe it's something else, and thanks for the opportunity to start the conversation. So first, I'm just going to start with the problem that this bill tries to address. Persistently low wages and benefits in the child care sector result in inadequate supply of child care and high turnover among child care workers. And just to illustrate why that is, the average child care worker's wage in Alaska is about $13.50 per hour without benefits, and compare that to $20 per hour with benefits at Target or a grocery store like Cars. So, you know, when you're talking about a $7 per hour delta without benefits, it's really no mystery why we have chronic undersupply of childcare and high turnover among childcare workers, even though I think all of us would acknowledge the childcare sector is very important to support every other sector. Unfortunately, when you have this kind of persistent low wages and benefits, it's hard to make an argument to invest in a new childcare center, for example, when we know the economics just aren't working right now. And, you know, 2 years ago when I introduced a couple of childcare bills to see what we could get support for, I didn't think that the problem could be any more acute in the childcare sector, and I was proven very wrong because the problem in the childcare sector has grown even more acute over the last 2 years, and we've seen from a wide range of business organizations how problematic it is to have an undersupply of quality childcare. We heard that at the Chamber of Commerce lunch last week. We've heard it recently from the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation, and those are just the most recent voices to really join in urging us to address the problems in childcare. So here's a news article from last week about how a shrinking workforce is hobbling Anchorage's economic recovery. If you have not read that AEDC report, I just cut out a section here that said employment in childcare centers and related areas fell by 7% in the first half of 2022. And, you know, compare that to the reality that people want to get back to work. So if we have falling employment in child care, and yet people want to get back to work, it just points at the undersupply of child care. I was somewhat shocked that employment in child care centers remain 9% below pre-pandemic levels. So unfortunately, some of the shocks and some of the centers going under, we just haven't recovered from that since the pandemic. I think it was also last week or the week before that that there were news reports about two more child care centers closing in Juneau. Valdez now has zero child care centers, obviously an important part of our oil industry and getting that oil to market. And over here on the right is an opinion piece that some child care providers wrote last year as the House was taking up the predecessor to this bill. And I think they make the good point that their problem is all of our problem, because whether it's construction, oil and gas, or another sector, Alaskans can't get to work if parents don't have a way for their kids to be taken care of, when the reality is a lot of families have to have two incomes just to get by, just to pay the bills. You know, we've also seen just in the last couple of months additional focus from economists and I think very appropriately from the governor on how you know, we need more people in Alaska. We've got to fix this out-migration problem. And childcare is absolutely central to doing that. I think when you look at the loss of population from Alaska over the last 10 years, unfortunately, we're losing the most critical subset of workers, people of working age. And when we don't have enough childcare and those folks can't go to work and pay the bills, unfortunately, it's sort of an incentive to go look elsewhere where there's more opportunity. So I really see a sense of urgency to fix that problem. So what are some of the lessons from other states, other nations? There's a broad range of ways that we can deal with this childcare crisis. And we did look at this a lot last year in the Labor and Commerce Committee. And I think a few takeaways are, number one, the bill that you see before you, House Bill 46, which establishes a sectoral bargaining structure for the childcare industry. Other states have successfully experimented with this model. And we did hear from childcare providers in some of those other states last year. And I guess I would also just note, every developed, advanced country on earth invests in childcare more than we do. And if we don't invest, we're going to have chronic undersupply. And unfortunately, that will hamper our economy. So what are the goals of this bill? Raise wages and benefits so that workers have a living wage. More workers enter the industry and fewer leave, thus increasing the supply of quality childcare. Again, so Alaskans can get to work. Because childcare is so expensive already, we need to do this in a way that avoids raising prices on parents. Many parents are at the limit of what they can pay. We need to ensure the economics work for employers. It would be a Pyrrhic victory to reduce prices for parents but make childcare centers uneconomic. And finally, I think because our childcare agency within the Department of Health does oversee a lot of pass-through federal funds, and because private sector economics are going to continue to change, the best public policy structure would be one that is flexible so that the industry can work with the state to ensure that our childcare sector is as strong as can be without going back and passing another bill every year. So let's have a resilient but also flexible policy structure that supports the industry. Why should we be considering this now? Again, we've seen even more urgency since the House acted on this last year. And just a few of the organizations I've heard from within the last few months, Northwest Arc Leadership Team, which includes NANA, Manelik, and other major employers from the Northwest, highlighted this at a conference for legislators in the fall. We just heard from the Chamber of Commerce last week, which added childcare to its set of policy priorities. Childcare, according to the Chamber, was one of the top three issues they heard from employers this year, the need to address childcare, and the Southeast Alaska Association for the Education of Young Children. That completes the presentation, and I will just close by briefly describing how the bill works. So House Bill 46 establishes sectoral bargaining for childcare providers. What that means is if this bill was passed, then the State Department of Labor, Alaska Labor Relations Agency, would conduct an election in which it would ask all childcare workers, do you want to engage in sectoral bargaining with the state? If a majority of workers voting in that election said yes, then they would either form or affiliate with a union and then negotiate with the state over things like wages, benefits, training. I think it's a good principle in general that when you have a regulated industry, whether it's childcare or the oil industry or any other, it's important that that industry have a strong voice with the state that regulates it. And I think we're generally going to have better public policy outcomes if the regulator takes into account the industry's voice on the front end rather than after issuing regulations. So the premise here is it's good for the industry to have a seat at the table, and within finite resource constraints, i.e. amount of federal dollars that the state is passing through, let's put those dollars to work in the best way possible. And when the industry has a seat at the table with the state, they are going to appropriate those dollars in a better fashion. And finally, this bill does contain language to establish a childcare trust fund, which was an idea that came out of the business community last year as this bill was progressing. And the notion of a trust fund is, as we have, say, sometimes we have an unexpected surge in revenue, perhaps we want to capitalize a trust fund that can sustainably inject more money into the sector and improve the stability within the sector. So you will see that the trust fund provision does not have a fiscal note. It's not assigning an amount of money, because frankly, I don't know that we could foresee what the right amount of money would be this year by the time this bill reaches the Finance Committee. But it gives us a vehicle to have a sustainable way of putting a little additional resources into the sector, again, with the goal of raising wages and stabilizing supply of childcare. So with that, I'm going to conclude the presentation. And Mr. Chairman, I might ask, if we can do invited testimony before the sectional, just out of respect for the testifier's time. Thank you.
Yep. So let's move right ahead to invited testimony. We'll start in the room. Mrs. Schreiber.
Hello. My name is Blue Scheibler. I live here in Juneau, Alaska. Thank you for holding this hearing today. It is really important that we're talking about childcare as a labor and commerce issue. I am currently the executive director of the local nonprofit that we've been around for 40 years. We promote high-quality learning for children, birth through eight, by supporting all who care, educate, and work for young children. I do have fewer than 15 employees, and I'm proud to say I don't discriminate against them. That was an interesting hearing. But prior to this work, I was a child care provider and business owner, and I employed, on average, 10 to 12 people at the child care center next door, actually, Discovery Preschool. And so while Representative Fields made a lot of the points that I was going to talk about today, I would like to just share some anecdotal experiences from the field. Prior to the pandemic, you know, we didn't have, well, there was always been a childcare shortage, and it's always been for the same reasons. Basically, the private market-based childcare system doesn't work well as a business model, and so it's sort of untenable for business owners, and it also fails to meet the needs of families. And that's largely because these private businesses have a single source of revenue. It's from families paying tuition. There's a cap to what you can charge before you're pricing people out of services. And so it's kind of always been an issue, but before the pandemic, we could really count on people coming to those jobs because they just enjoyed the work. It's a really fun job, and it's very rewarding. Since the pandemic and rising costs of living, I think we're seeing more and more people have to choose jobs that also pay the bills. It can't just be a job that they enjoy. And so we're seeing fewer and fewer people come to this work. In Juneau, for example, we monitor enrollment levels of all the child care center programs here, and all of them are under-enrolled, some of them by about 50%. So they have capacity to take more kids, but they can't because they can't hire staff to take care of them. And again, they're up against regulations that require a certain ratio of adults to children in their programs. So while there's always been a capacity issue, now it's more of a childcare business isn't able to operate in a free market in this labor market because they can't raise wages. So, you know, because childcare jobs don't pay the bills and we have this worker shortage, which is causing a worker shortage in all these other sectors, and if we recognize that childcare as a business model is in market failure and that childcare is also a public good and one that fiscal stability relies on, I think it's time for the state to take action to fix the broken childcare system. And I think that fix has to start with an investment in the workforce. Allowing the sector to collectively bargain for what they need in order to thrive is a good start to what needs to be a comprehensive plan to significantly improve workplace conditions for providers and childcare business owners.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Prox.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. Through the chair, you represent an association of child care providers, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Prox, I am with a nonprofit that offers a variety of supports to child care providers. I don't represent them.
Oh, okay.
One of the activities that we engage in often here is administering publicly local dedicated funds from the city and borough of Juneau in the way of operating subsidies for child care programs. And so I have a lot of interaction with the programs here.
Okay. And follow up. And why I'm asking, I'm trying to get some sort of an idea of how what percentage of the child care is provided through private private transactions versus state, is it state subsidized service? Are there any child care providers that are not relying on publicly appropriated money for their business?
Yes, the majority of child care providers in Juneau are privately owned businesses that don't receive a subsidy.
Okay, so they're interacting with Fred's hardware store or somebody else's accounting office as opposed to the state for payment. The state or the city of Roanoke, Juneau.
Correct. Most of their income is from private pay families. And or so there is a child care assistance program. Is that what you're asking about? Where families that meet certain income eligibility guidelines can get a subsidy from the state to help offset the cost of tuition.
Right. Through the chair. Yes, there is a state child care assistance. You have to meet certain income guidelines, but if you're above those, then I guess you have to go find your own child care provider wherever.
Correct.
Okay.
Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you. Through the chair, thank you for being here today. Appreciate your testimony. You mentioned multiple times something called you label as market failure. That sounds dramatic, and maybe it is. Can you describe that a little bit further for me, just so I can understand? Because it sounds like it's I'm just going to put it out there, but multitude of issues from workforce not being present to people not maybe being able to afford it, or maybe they want to afford it and they don't have places to send them. And then also it sounds like it's a poor business model. I maybe don't understand that piece of it either, so maybe just a brief explanation of that would be great.
Sure.
Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Ruffridge. I guess the reason that it's often talked about in market failures because as a business, it doesn't make a profit, and it also doesn't pay a worthy wage. Whereas a traditional business would look at these razor-thin margins that most child care providers or child care business owners make, and they would just say, why would I do that? Why would I start a business like that? That's just crazy making. So in a traditional business, you could do things like raise the cost of your goods and services to make up for a higher cost of operating. In child care, you just can't do that because parents can't afford to pay any more. And so a business, a private childcare business, is often operating because they just like the work and they're meeting a need for a public service. But because it's not an attractive business to come to, because profit margins are so slim or negative, we don't see a lot of growth in the sector. And so in that way, I do think it's a market failure. It can't exist in a free market economy in terms of like being able to make a profit and be sustainable on its own.
Just a brief follow-up again. Yeah, so thank you for that explanation. So in your estimation, potentially the only way for childcare to operate in this state and do well is for the state to subsidize childcare in some fashion. And I obviously trying to understand the bill in its totality, and I have probably some questions for Representative Fields on that, but I'm not understanding the link between what this bill would do and how it will keep costs down to the parents, because I feel like some of those issues might still exist even with collective bargaining, such as market failure. So where does the injection of cash come from into the market to essentially keep that thing afloat?
Thank you. Through the chair, yes, I would say that might need to come from a state subsidy, and I don't know exactly how much or what the mechanism for that would be. That might be a question that's better for Representative Fields.
Okay.
But I do think that that's necessary, and I think that nationally we're seeing that happen and that recognition come about in a very bipartisan way in Congress and through other public policy groups that because this is a public good that can't stand on its own, public investment is needed to make it robust.
Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, ma'am, could you repeat your name again? I didn't catch it.
Yeah, it's blue, like the color. Scheibler.
Miss Blue. Last name?
Scheibler.
Scheibler. Thank you, Scheibler. I got a couple questions. My first question was going to be, well, my understanding of macroeconomics, basic economics, is the invisible hand of the market decides what people will pay for a good or service. And I don't know if child care has ever been an industry that has paid generous wages. Have we had an experience where heretofore people who worked in child care or in the businesses were able to make a profit? Is this a new problem or a continuing problem for a long time?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, this has been a problem in all of my 20 years that I've been in the sector. And like I said before, it has always been an issue of low wages. But with higher costs of living, people are just not choosing to come to this work.
Okay. Follow up? Okay. Through the chair, so my question was going to be where the money comes from. Well, actually, I'll avoid that because it sounds like you said it would require a state subsidy. But my question is could you give kind of an overview for those of us who are either past the child-raising years or those who are not part of it? What is the current system for paying people that provide child care? Is it all private? Is it all public? Is there a combination? Is there subsidies? Help us understand that system that would then help us understand how this bill would alter that system to reach the outcomes you're looking for.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I don't know all of the answer to that question, but in general, the child care system is largely made up of private businesses who at all different levels. There's family child care homes and there's child care centers, and they all employ a number of providers. So there are hundreds of providers working in these various child care programs. Mostly privately employed. There are some nonprofits and some for-profits. But they all make around the same wage, and all of the prices of the care is about the same. And so I'm not sure if I'm completely addressing your question, but they all make around the same wage and I think would benefit from a bill like this where they could get together and give their voice of what they would like to see changed.
And follow up, and we're closing on that actually. So this would, the title in the bill says, this would allow child care workers to organize and bargain with the State Department of Health. Why is that important? What role does the State Department of Health play in funding child care services?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, the Department of Health receives and administers federal block grants that are designed to fund child care activities in all states. And so the Department of Health, through the Department of Public Assistance and through the Child Care Program Office, makes decisions about how those federal funds are best used. And there are federal guidelines, of course, but that's where they play a role.
To follow up, so the federal government provides grants to the state, and the state shares those with child care providers? Or roughly, okay. How much of the total cost of child care does the federal government bear in Alaska?
Well, in terms of the cost, I think that's mostly related to part of the federal block grant being used for the child care assistance subsidy program. So they're actually paying providers on behalf of families that qualify. And then the other parts of the federal block grant that fund child care largely contribute to training activities. Not a lot of it goes directly to business owners or wages or the workers.
Okay. But still, I haven't heard kind of what percentage, how much of the money that ends up in child care workers' pockets comes from the federal block grants, and how much from just people, from parents or child guardians giving them money.
I'm sorry, I do not know the answer to that.
The bill envisions authorizing child care workers to bargain with the Department of Health. It's important for us to understand how much of the market this would address. And I can see the sponsor nodding. So thanks.
Thank you, Mrs. Schreiber. I think we will move along to invited testimony of Dr. Brower.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Oh, my line is unmuted. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you. Thank you. Go ahead. Thank you.
Great. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. I'm members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify today regarding HB 46. My name is Dr. Pearl Brower, and I currently serve as the president and CEO of Aklyakovic Nupiat Corporation. We're the 10th largest company by revenue in the state of Alaska, owned by the shareholders of our northernmost Alaskan community in Barrow. And prior to this, I was the president of Iliusovik College, Alaska's only tribal college and only independent community college in our state. I was at the college for 13 years and 8 of those serving as president. The primary purpose of my testimony is to say thank you so much to this committee and the legislature for taking on this really incredibly critically important issue of child care and its role in the economic health of our state. Nearly every business in our state is facing workforce shortages, and in many cases, Alaskans can't go back to work because parents can't find child care. I was just reading an article in the Alaska Business Monthly when I was heading home from Juneau earlier last week that actually discussed this critical issue as well. That's why the Alaska Chamber of Commerce has prioritized child care as one of the issues business leaders hope you address this year, and why the Northwest Arctic Leadership Team and the Southeast Alaska Association for Education of Young Children are advocating on behalf of this bill. I would offer that dozens of other organizations would sign on to this effort as well. I've lived through the challenges around child care. Lack of adequate child care in Barrow, which is my hometown, is one of the reasons my family relocated to Anchorage. It is also one reason why it is challenging for me to move my entire family back home again to Barrow. We don't have any institutionalized child care options at home right now, and the few in-home care opportunities are completely full and have a very long wait list. In addition, while at Iliusovik, we ran an early learning center as a child care center, but we had to close it down. We also received funding to support child care facilities in North Slope villages across the slope, but due to the lack of workforce, and support, we were unable to get them up and running. So I want to note that this isn't just a rural Alaskan issue. From the North Slope to Southeast Alaska, child care shortages endanger economic security for families, leave children at elevated risk of neglect, and make it difficult, if not impossible, for companies like mine to fill jobs, good paying jobs that are necessary to achieve our full economic potential in our state. And let's be clear, I don't just hear this issue around our offices in Barrow, but around our offices at Anchorage as well. We have a statewide crisis. Last year, the House passed child care reform legislation very similar to the bill before you today. And as a business person and a mom, thank you for tackling this issue early in the session. And I ask you to please continue to work together to craft the strongest legislation that can pass and stabilize the child care sector. I know my current child care provider in Anchorage would very much appreciate this conversation. And when you are successful, which I hope you will be, it will help families and businesses across the state in immeasurable ways. So thank you so much. I very much appreciate this time and wish you all good luck in this conversation.
Thank you, Dr. Brower. I think we have a question from Representative Prox.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. Through the chair, this corporation, I forgot the pronunciation of it, but this is a for-profit corporation?
Through the chair, Representative Prox, yes, we are a for-profit corporation.
Okay, and follow-up? I'm trying to understand, I guess, why the corporation doesn't elect to provide a benefit to employees or to subsidize that service for its own employees.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Representative I would offer that one of the challenges that if there isn't the workforce to offer that subsidies to support, we'd be right back at the beginning. The issue is even if we had a subsidy, which is an interesting conversation piece that I might be starting to think about, we don't even have the workforce to have anybody take advantage of that subsidy.
Well, if I might clarify that, what I'm thinking is that if the wage for the child care provider is too low, if someone pays more to that provider, you would expect an increase in supply of providers. And it's a question of who's going to pay the extra. Is it going to be the, shall we say, private businesses or the state that pays the extra? And it would seem to me that one solution would be for businesses, the private market, to essentially increase the benefits offered to their employees, and then the problem would take care of itself. The market would take care of itself. And why, I'm not understanding why that isn't happening, why businesses aren't voluntarily choosing to address the problem themselves.
Through the chair, Representative, I mean, that's an interesting question and conversation. I don't have a specific answer to that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Brower. I think we'll move along to Mrs. Eubanks. Are you on the line?
Yes.
Hi. Go ahead. We can hear you.
Thank you for the committee, Chair Sumner, for hearing Bill 46 and allowing me the opportunity to testify. I'm the Executive Director of Hope Park Children's Center in Anchorage. We have provided child care services in Anchorage for over 50 years. The reality of poor wages and benefits for this workforce detrimentally impacts the working family. A healthy early learning system requires a variety of providers, both home and center-based, that are well-trained and compensated and have a voice in their work conditions. I believe that House Bill 46 before you is an avenue to address this. Attracting and retaining a quality workforce has been a continued struggle during the 20 years I've worked in Alaska providing child care services. While the state has changed regulations that increase the cost of care, the reimbursement rates have not kept pace. This has met an increased cost to families and continued low wages and little to no benefits for the workers. The foundation of a high-quality early childhood system is a well-trained and fairly compensated workforce. Unfortunately, Alaska's system does not provide their livable wages to keep a trained workforce. Early childhood educators are one of the lowest paid professions in the state. While the cost of child care is high, often comparable to a monthly mortgage or rent payment, the income does not cover overhead and wages. This leads to high rates of turnover in providers, which is alarming because consistency in caregiving during a child's formative years is essential to provide a secure foundation for the child to grow from. This financial investment in early childhood saves the state money in education and health costs in the long term. While this bill does not fix all of the issues in early childhood, it provides a policy solution that allows a greater voice for staff, center directors, and home providers in working with the state child care program office. The industry should have a voice in decisions that impact the cost of care. Child care providers are the experts at providing child care in Alaska and should be afforded a seat at the table. At the beginning of COVID, the Child Care Program Office had written regulations that would have incentivized child care providers to close. A year before that, the office had proposed regulation changes that would have substantially increased the cost of care for families. Providers had to explain the ramifications to the office. HB 46 would enable providers to be at the table from the beginning to work together with the department to come up with solutions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Eubanks. Are there any questions? Representative Prox has a question for you.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Sumner. Through the chair, I guess sort of the same question. As a provider, I can see where individual businesses might have a hard time charging more, but what prevents the providers from simply raising their prices at this point?
through the chair to Representative Cox. Thank you for your question. There isn't, and the fact is prices are going up. For the last 2 years, we've done a 5% increase, and this year it's seriously going to look to be a minimum of 6%, if not a 10% increase of our average tuition, which is $1,300 a month. So what you're doing is, you know, what you're doing is making childcare affordable for high-income parents, and then you're pricing out all your service workers.
Thank you, Mrs. Eubanks. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mrs. Eubanks, could you repeat that? I'm not quite sure I followed the line of your answer to the question. The question is simply, if wages are too low and the market would support it, why does not the provider raise its costs so it can collect more from clients and pay more to employees?
Because only a few percentage of families can afford $1,500 to $1,800 a month per child in childcare costs. So if you are an hourly worker and you're working at Cars for $20 or $25 an hour with benefits, you're not necessarily going to be able to pay $1,500 to $1,800 a month in childcare on top of the increased cost of housing. And that's what we're just seeing. So yeah, we're full, but the costs are coming up that you're going to even having middle class families are starting to not be able to afford childcare. And that's for one kid. So if you're having two kids, like, you know, I've had some families that are paying $3,000 to almost $4,000 a month.
Thank you. And I'd like to take this minute to please remind all the testifiers and the sponsors to have your invited testifiers submit their testimony in writing as well. It'd be helpful for the work of the committee. Representative Fields, if you would like to finish up here.
Mr. Chairman, do you want to do more questions now or go to the sectional?
Let's go to the sectional.
No, let's do more. We've got another opportunity. Go ahead.
Yeah.
You run the meeting now.
we'll proceed to the sectional, Representative Fields.
Yeah.
Okay. My staff, Evan Anderson, is going to go through the sectional.
Through the chair, Evan Anderson, staff to Representative Fields. I'll quickly walk us through the sectional for House Bill 46. This is version A. Section 1 amends AS 23.5.360, subsection F, to allow the Alaska Labor Relations Agency Board in the Department of Labor and Workforce Development the authority to include workers in the child care sector for the purpose of holding hearings. This is a conforming change to the language added in Section 4. That'll be true for Section 2 and 3 as well. In Section 2, this section amends AS 23.5.370, subsection A, to direct the Alaska Labor Relations Agency to serve as the labor relations agency for workers in the child care sector, covered by the new language added in Section 4. So Section 3, this section amends AS 23.5.380 to give DLWD the authority to update regulations pertaining to collective bargaining rights for workers in the child care sector. This is also a conforming change. If you flip open your copy of the bill, you'll see that the majority of the text is contained within Section 4. This section amends AS 23.40 to give child care providers the right to self-organize, join, or assist an organization to bargain collectively and engage in concerted activities for the purposes of collective bargaining or other mutual aid or protection. The section also prohibits the Department of Health from engaging in unfair labor practices and outlines what those might be. And it also provides a process for investigation and conciliation of complaints. This section also provides a page worth of definitions for all the terms that come up in the bill. Section number 5 is the final section and establishes the Child Care Provider Fund as a separate fund in the state treasury. This section also establishes a child care stakeholder group to recommend disbursements from the fund.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, If I might just try to answer one of the questions that came up earlier.
Representative Fields?
I think through the chair, both Representative Sadler and Representative Prox had questions around basically what happens if we don't invest in this sector. And I think the short answer is if we don't invest in the sector, we have a chronic undersupply of child care where only people who make six figures or more can afford to have child care. And we can do that. The problem is we're basically pushing all these people out of the workforce and we're not meeting our full economic capacity. Every other advanced country on earth invests substantially more than we do as a state on a per child basis. So I think there's just a lot of evidence from around the world that when we make modest investments in childcare, we do better overall economically because we allow people who need to go to work, to pay the bills to go to work, and they fill jobs, as referenced by Dr. Brower, that our employers are looking to fill. And then the question is, well, if we need to invest more, then how? And the vehicle in this bill is to establish a childcare trust. And, you know, my concept there is, I think, a lot of decades of experiences. Alaska has wildly volatile revenue. And my concept is when we have revenue on the upswing, let's put some of that money into a fund and sustainably invest in childcare. And that money is there, paid out under an endowment model when revenues fall. So it's basically a fiscally conservative way of modestly increasing investment in the sector. It is worth noting too, even if we didn't have additional revenue this year or next year, giving providers a seat at the table would help lead to better allocation of those limited resources that are largely federal pass-through dollars. So I hope that helps answer some of those questions that came up to the invited testifiers. Thank you.
Representative Sadler and then Prox.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Fields, I'm afraid I don't recall me asking the question, what happens if we don't pass the bill or make the investments? My questions were actually, who pays for it? I do notice that Section 5 talks about, that I've seen this language before, creates a fund will consist of funds appropriated to it, earnings and so forth, but this has to be populated. It sounds like you're envisioning a dedicated endowment for the child care, which I don't think we may do. So my question again, which I asked the two, I think one of the women testifying is, could you help us understand what is the money flow and payment? Where's the source of money that's paid to child care workers in Alaska? Right. And why would this, what role does the Department of Health play? How would collective bargaining with the Department of Health change things? I certainly understand the benefits of people getting more pay. I understand clearly. But who's going to pay for it? How would it work? Please elucidate.
Thanks to the chair. So the model here is sort of like the Higher Education Trust Fund. So it's designated or not dedicated. And I would defer to the director of the Child Care Program Office, who I don't think is online right now, but we can get back to you with the exact amount of money. But in general, for child care providers who have subsidized slots, because each subsidized slot under previous regulations was not paying for the actual cost of care, basically what you've had is providers will balance subsidized slots not paying the cost of care, and then they will essentially overcharge private pay parents to fill that delta. So in general, at most providers who I've talked with, you've had a majority of private pay families whose own dollars, my dollars as a parent, are subsidizing the subsidized parents. I know that probably sounds hard to understand, but our previous rate structure, again, this was administered through the Child Care Program Office, just didn't keep pace with the actual cost of care. The department very recently updated those rates, and we can share with you what they are by region. They're better. I don't think those rates are going to be sufficient to attract the workforce that we need, certainly in South Central.
Through the chair, a follow-up, if I may. I think, Representative Fields, you're presuming a level of knowledge about the intricacies of the child care funding and payment system that I simply do not have. In simple terms, break down for me and the members of the committee how money is paid for child care. How much is paid by private people? How much does the federal government give to the states?
Yep.
Very simple, broad terms, please.
Through the chair, I apologize. So my wife and I pay for child care for our two girls, and we write a check to our child care center. Mm-hmm. Actually, we have two, one in Anchorage, one in Juneau. So those centers both have subsidized slots. That's a choice of the center. So for those centers that accept subsidized slot, they also receive payments directly from the state for those children. Now, a child care center or, you know, a home-based provider could choose only to have private pay families because the economics of these subsidized slots have been very challenging. So I think when we think about as policymakers, we're trying to make it work for both sets of parents, right? The private pay parents and the ones who currently qualify for subsidies. And when we look at childcare, one of the policy levers other states have looked at is what is our threshold of eligibility for childcare subsidies? A lot of other states, including some pretty conservative states, have said, hey, to get the workforce we need, we actually need more parents to be eligible for these subsidies. That's one policy lever.
Representative Prox.
Thank you, Chair Ruffridge. Through the chair, we're hitting at a problem I'm concerned about, that if we don't make some other changes to make the customers, the parents that need the service, eligible for a subsidized service, we're just going to move it a little bit. And then we have the problem at a higher level. And it will be solved by continually increasing the state subsidy to the industry, kind of like we're doing with hospitals and Medicare now. Medicaid, sorry. We're underpaying the service provider and consequently private insurance companies and private payers to hospitals are picking up the tab. I'm thinking we have to do more than just give the providers the ability to set the price, because they're going to price themselves out of the market.
Through the chair, Representative Prox, I think you're right. They have the nominal ability to raise the price, but if they do, they're pricing out so many parents that it totally breaks down. And I think that your analogy of Medicare underpaying and that having kind of pernicious ripple effects in other sectors of the market is maybe an apt analogy.
I'd give that some thought. Thank you.
Representative Kerr.
Yeah, through the chair to Representative Fields, I have a quick, easy question and then a follow-up comment. This bill, just double-checking, covers both the home-based providers and the entities like Discovery Preschool.
Through the chair, it covers all licensed providers, excellent. Some of whom are very small.
Also, as a follow-up, we're really covering two basic challenges with affordability in Alaska and availability of childcare. One is just the lack of childcare centers and opportunities for parents and the lack of affordability for parents. And we're also, it's a circular issue because you also have the lack of ability to attract and retain childcare workers when they can go down the street and get a job at Fred's instantaneously for a potentially higher wage. And also, frankly, an easier job. I mean, this childcare work is very difficult. And just a comment, we heard in the governor's State of the State speech last week that we want to go pre-K all the way through 18 years old in terms of investing in children and investing in families. This is a tool to do that in my mind, especially since we are covering all types of providers. It's not a one-size-fits-all solution, but I see it as a tool. The question of who pays for is definitely important, but it's not the only question to ask in having this conversation. So I want to thank the sponsor for bringing this bill forward and having this conversation.
Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Fields, for Representative Fields for being here. So I asked a question a little earlier on the ability, it was in the slide, of this to either keep costs neutral to parents or potentially, don't raise prices on parents. So, and maybe I'll put words in your mouth here for a second, but I'm guessing this is an initial step to allow collective bargaining. The bullet point about don't raise prices on parents, though, really is dependent on how this subsidy thing might, that's not really contained within this bill, how that would work. So there's a potential that the collective bargaining could raise prices on parents, but the hope would be that it doesn't with some sort of subsidy down the road. Am I wrong in that assessment?
Uh, through the chair, I think that's a pretty good description. A goal of the bill is to hold down prices on parents. Unfortunately, we're already seeing prices rise as we talked about the predecessor to this bill. Over the previous 2 years, I learned a lot of details about the childcare sector I was unaware of. And all those details really brought home for me the importance of having providers drive the conversation, because I think each provider is going to have a really good idea of meeting the needs of those parents. And when providers are in the driver's seat thinking about how to provide the best care within cost constraints of parents, they're going to make a better decision than we would. And that's why this bill establishes a framework as opposed to, say, setting a minimum wage in the sector. I don't think I have enough information to set the perfect minimum wage that would be, you know, perfect over time to changing market conditions. So this establishes a framework to empower providers, because I think they will make very good decisions because they're closest to the parents and the kids.
And then just a follow-up to that question, you don't envision or have attached to this bill in any way a dollar amount to initially start the trust. The trust would be in statute if this bill should pass, but that would be a wish and a prayer that there would be money put in there at some point?
That is correct.
Okay.
Through the chair, there was discussion last year in the Senate when we had this huge surge of revenue that, oh, we could afford a $50 million child care trust. Some people were pushing that. I don't know what the revenue picture is going to look like in, you know, 3 months or 12 months. So it is very much contingent on revenue. But I do think when we have these wild revenue swings, positioning ourselves to make a one-time investment with long-term benefits is a wise thing to do. And that's why I like the trust fund model.
Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Fields. Before I can evaluate whether this bill is good policy, I have to understand clearly the current system of funding for child care. So a real clear question and a real clear answer. How is child care paid for in Alaska now? How much is paid for privately? How much is paid for by government grants, federal pass-through, state grants? And a couple follow-ups.
Through the chair, the vast majority is paid for private pay by parents, with some augmented by federal pass-through funding in the form of per-child subsidized slots for eligible parents. But on the precise percentage, again, I have to ask the CCPO director because I don't know the precise percentage offhand.
It would be great to have that because that gets to, and I see this bill has two tracks. One is unionizing child care workers. The other is establishing a fund to subsidize the state subsidy. And so I'm not sure if this bill would, if the majority of child care wages are paid not by the state, I'm not sure if this bill would touch much of the problem. It would leave the entire private paid system as it is, subject to the same market economics factors. Is that correct?
Through the chair, your breakdown, Representative Sadler, is correct. The idea of marrying sectoral bargaining with a trust fund is that whatever additional resources come into that sector, really there should be strong consultation with the sector over how to disperse those resources to have the maximum benefit. And that would be true if a bill from Congress increased funding for child care as well.
And a final follow-up, good. Again, I see the legislation creates a fund. It does not identify a source for the funds. And certainly there are many things that we could do well if we could endow a lot of programs with a trust fund. This is one of them, but absent a funding source, I think this is a highly aspirational element of your bill.
Representative Wright, did you have a question?
Yes, through the chair, how much do we receive through the federal block grant on a yearly basis?
I'm going to check with the child, through the chair, I'll check with the child care program office and get back to you on the precise number.
Okay, and just to follow up, the Worthy Wage campaign, how's that working? What does that do anything for this? Is there...
I apologize, Mr. Chairman. Representative, through the chair, could you repeat that question?
Or the wage campaign. Do you know what that is?
Or,
so it's usually, you mind? So it's a campaign that usually on a yearly basis advocates for child care services to raise the wages. Is that something that you know about at all? No?
Through the chair, it's not ringing a bell.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you for your presentation, Representative Fields, and I'd like to thank all the invited testimony. Seeing no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect. The time is 5:02.